That's the universally recognized and dreaded sound of a mosquito buzzing your ear, although we tend to think of them as the things that can spoil a summer day outside. In many parts of the world, mosquitoes are deadly vectors of disease. For today's Please Explain Look at Mosquitoes, we are joined by Dr. Anand Sankar Ray, Associate Professor of Entomology at the University of California, Riverside, and by Dr. Philip Lunibus, a professor at the Institute of Food and Agricultural Studies at the Florida Medical Entomology Laboratory at the University of Florida, Vero Beach. I'm very pleased to welcome both of them to today's Please Explain Look at Mosquitoes. Hi.
Hi. Hello. Thank you for having us.
And as always, we invite our listeners to join the conversation. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692. Or write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Philip, how long have mosquitoes been on the planet? Do we know?
We have some estimates. They don't fossilize very well, but they are known from fossil records back 100 million years, back in the Miocene or Cretaceous period. So they were around with dinosaurs long before humans were even an idea.
And I wonder if dinosaurs were annoyed by them. Are they related? Are they related to any other kinds of flying insects?
Oh, of course. Mosquitoes are what we call Diptera, which includes all the flies, and they are a specific family, the Culicidae of the flies, which are distinguished by entomologists by a certain type of wing venation and scales on the wings, as well as their long proboscis, which, of course, has caused the most annoyance because that's part of the adaptation for blood sucking.
Around how many, Anand, how many different types of mosquitoes are they, and are they all blood suckers?
Well, there are about 3,500 described species, and I think that there's still new ones being discovered as we speak. While most of these feed on vertebrate blood, not all, but most of them, very few of them feed on human blood. So I would say only about 200 species are known to feed on human blood and can therefore transmit diseases.
Can you tell the different species just by looking at them with the naked eye?
I think in most cases there are morphological markers that you can find under a microscope and be able to tell. But in some instances, it's important to do some detective work using molecular tools where you can look at a piece of DNA sequence and be able to place them in a specific species. In fact, molecular tools and dating based on genome sequence suggests that mosquitoes are at least about 200 million years old. And while most of them evolved while with other vertebrates, some of them perhaps co-evolved or adapted when humans appeared on planet Earth.
Now, what about the buzz? Is that do they all sound pretty much the same?
I think the wing beat frequency is what when the mosquitoes are flying around, their wing beat has a certain frequency, and this is what we hear as that annoying buzz going around our ear, especially in the dark. You can tell whether a mosquito is making a beeline for you. The wing beat frequency is different for different species, and in fact, you can use LED light to record the wing beat frequency and be able to tell the difference between one species and the other to a certain degree. That noise also changes whether or not a mosquito is male or female, and also depending on how large they are.
Well, since it's only the females who bite us, should I feel a little more relaxed if I can tell the difference between the male and the female buzz?
That's an interesting question. Well, where there are males, there will certainly be females as well. In fact, males will oftentimes form a swarm. You may have noticed on a summer evening that there's a swarm of mosquitoes above an object flying around, and oftentimes these swarms are really the male mosquitoes that are buzzing around together, hoping that a female will be able to tell them from a distance. So, yes, a male wouldn't bite you. In fact, a male cannot bite you. They don't have specialized mouth part that is required for puncturing the skin. But where there are males, there will invariably also be females.
Philip, it's been raining a lot recently in New York City. Do wet springs and early summers translate into higher numbers of mosquitoes?
Yes, in general. We, as an ecologist, we don't make the connection perfectly, but certainly water is a prerequisite for mosquito development since their larval and pupal stages are aquatic. And the warmer, up to a certain point that the weather is, the faster that development should occur, and there will be metamorphosis to those annoying flying adults.
Is there any place on the planet where mosquitoes aren't found?
I don't believe that there is any record from the Antarctic. In the Arctic Circle, just south in the tundra region, there certainly are mosquitoes, and that area is infamous during snowmelt periods when overwintering eggs are hatched by the snowmelt, and usually mosquitoes of the genus Aedes come out and are ferocious biters. I certainly would not want to be a caribou during that springtime melt.
Well, with global warming, I imagine the Inuit are going to have to start worrying more about being bitten by mosquitoes.
I think that's true. We do know that mosquitoes are changing their lifestyle in adaptation to the warmer climates.
My guests are Dr. Philip Lunabas, a professor at the Institute of Food and Agricultural Studies at the Florida Medical Entomology Laboratory, University of Florida, Vero Beach, and Dr. Anand Sankar Ray, Associate Professor of Entomology at the University of California, Riverside. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and we're talking about mosquitoes on today's Please Explain, and inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Even if they're a nuisance, are mosquitoes or mosquito larvae an important part of the ecology in environments because they provide food for other species?
Sure. There's no question, I think, that in the greater scheme of things, that the larvae, particularly the immature stages, larvae and pupae, are food for other aquatic organisms, usually larger, that are predatory and rely on eating mosquitoes as prey for their nutrition. That includes fish, which, by the way, can be a very valuable biological control of mosquitoes. And surprisingly, actually adult mosquitoes in some parts of the world are important pollinators, and that actually includes some Arctic tundra orchids that are known to be pollinated only by adult mosquitoes.
Well, I can't bring fish into my backyard. So are any natural predators, are there any natural predators, ladybugs or something, that prey on mosquitoes, or do I just have to use some of the other more tried and true methods of
well,
avoiding being bitten?
If you're obviously thinking more of the annoying adults, I wouldn't rule out the fact that spiders certainly catch a fair number of mosquitoes in their webs, and some parts of the world studies have indicated that they can consume a substantial number of mosquitoes. There was a wave of interest actually in cultivating bats in certain areas as potential control agents for mosquitoes. And it is true that bats will eat mosquitoes, but they tend to be generalist consumers of flying insects. And I don't know of any study that shows that bats have actually specifically reduced mosquito populations.
And the bat population is decreasing in the Northeast, while mosquito populations seem to be thriving. A listener wonders, whether HIV can be transmitted by mosquitoes, because mosquitoes are vectors for so many other illnesses like malaria, dengue fever, yellow fever, West Nile.
It's interesting that that was a very serious concern in the general public before much was known about transmission of HIV. And mosquitoes really are only effective transmitters of viruses that can replicate inside them. And HIV as a retrovirus is not known. There's no studies shown that it can replicate inside a mosquito or any other insect. So I suppose there is an incredibly infinitesimal chance that a mosquito could act as a flying needle, so to speak, and pick up a few particles of HIV virus from someone that was viremic and then mechanically transmitted, but the likelihood is infinitesimally small. And that's in contrast to the viruses that we are very well acquainted with, such as West Nile, which is highly adapted to being multiplying in a female Culex mosquito, and hence that mosquito compounds the problem by the incredible capacity of that virus to replicate inside it, and then it infects the salivary glands. And when that mosquito blood feeds, its salivary expectorate is injected into a new host.
Now, Anand, do different mosquitoes specialize in different illnesses? Is there only one kind of mosquito that would infect us with West Nile?
No, actually, there's a range of mosquito species that can transmit any of these given diseases. Oftentimes, it's one particular mosquito species that is more effective at transmitting a specific disease. So, for example, the most deadly animal on planet Earth has often been called the Anopheles gambi mosquito, which is an important vector for Plasmodium falciparum in Africa. So while there are about 20 other anophelin species of mosquitoes that can transmit Plasmodium, Anopheles gambi is particularly effective and efficient at transmitting this disease. So there can be a group of mosquito species that can transmit any given disease. However, for example, dengue virus cannot be transmitted by anopheline mosquitoes. The dengue virus is normally transmitted by mosquitoes belonging to Aedes groups.
Now, earlier this week on a segment about the history of New York, we learned that people in Brooklyn were dying of malaria as late as 1910. Why has the disease been largely eradicated here while it continues to be such a problem on a large part of the rest of the planet?
Well, there was a huge number of deaths due to malaria in the early 1900s, and it was a significant challenge in the United States to try and eradicate malaria. And I believe that the way it worked was a number of different strategies were included, including insecticides that killed the mosquito. There was a lot of effort in controlling water, stagnant water, along with the use of air conditioning and people moving indoors and becoming generally more aware of taking an integrated approach to control mosquitoes. So essentially what happened is for a few years, potentially, the number of people carrying the malarial parasite dropped enough in number that it broke the transmission cycle. So this is an important aspect to keep in mind, is that you can break the cycle of transmission for malaria if you can sufficiently reduce the population of people carrying malaria, treating them with drugs like chloroquine at that time. And so once the disease transmission cycle was broken, then there was care was taken to control the population of mosquitoes that subsequently showed up, monitored them. And all of this required resources, required a significant amount of effort, and I'm glad that everybody's glad that it worked here. To be able to translate that effort in a tropical country or tropical countries in Africa and Asia is quite a significantly bigger challenge because of just the fact that mosquitoes can breed and grow so much faster in the tropics, and the amount of resources that are available are more limited.
My guess, I have to take a look. Go ahead.
Leonard, is that just to make a connection between something else that Anand already said about Anopheles gambiae, it is far and away the most effective, is the best vector of malaria in the world by many times. And the vectors of malaria, although we have competent Anopheles species in the North America, and so we are capable of establishing a mini outbreak if an infected individual possibly gets bitten by one of these vectors. They are not, the North American carriers are not nearly as good at transmitting malaria. So the challenge is exacerbated in a place like Africa to get rid of malaria because of the presence of Anopheles gambiae, the best vector species in the world.
We have to take a little break, and we will come back with more of a discussion of mosquitoes. I want to find out why some people are bitten more than others and your suggestions for how to actually get rid of them or at least protect ourselves from them. My guests are Dr. Philip Lunibas, a professor at the Institute of Food and Agricultural Studies at the Florida Medical Entomology Laboratory, University of Florida in Vero Beach, and Dr. Anand Sankar Ray, Associate Professor of Entomology at the University of California, Riverside. We'll be taking a lot of calls in our second part as well, so stay with us. We are back with our guests for today's Please Explain, Look at Mosquitoes, Dr. Philip Lunibas of the University of Florida and Dr. Ananda Sankar Ray of the University of California, Riverside. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. I know some people who are constantly being bitten by mosquitoes all throughout the summer and others who rarely get bitten. Do mosquitoes discriminate?
Yes, indeed they do. Mosquitoes, the female mosquito, finds us using the sense of smell. So they are incredibly good at smelling us out from a distance. And they use a variety of different odors that we emit in our breath, like carbon dioxide, as well as odors that are emitted from our skin. Now, different people have differences in skin chemistry, and therefore they have subtle changes in the type of odors that they emit. So the overall bouquet of odors emitted from one person can be slightly different from that of another. And mosquitoes, the female, can distinguish between individuals using these skin odorants. So it is thought that there are some individuals who produce slightly higher quantities of more attractive odors, while others may be producing a slightly higher quantity of unattractive odors for the mosquito.
And it's CO2 that attracts them as much as anything? We all breathe out CO2.
Well, that's a very interesting question. So carbon dioxide in our exhaled air, a breath, is a strong activating attractant that can draw a mosquito towards us from a distance. So as the female is flying around, when it comes across a plume or a puff of CO2 from that has been exhaled by a vertebrate, the mosquito will fly upwind, spend the energy, navigate closer. But when it comes closer to us, then it starts using several sensors that detect odors from our skin, but also heat and humidity, and that enables the mosquito to become a really guided missile. So you can imagine the mosquito doesn't really fly into our mouth. They come close to us, and then in a very sophisticated series of movements, it will navigate away from our mouth and towards the skin. It's not fully understood how they do that and what cues they use, but the idea is that some individuals are slightly more attractive than others, and if they are present together in a picnic, the mosquito will be able to find the more delicious smelling person in the crowd better.
And some mosquitoes seem to focus on our ankles and our calves, others on our arms or the higher parts of our body. Are they different kinds of mosquitoes, or are we just emitting different smells?
That behavior is specific to different species of mosquitoes. In fact, we need to do more studies on that. As Anand mentioned, that we are still missing a lot of the important behavior elements and how they do it. But some, for example, the species that transmits dengue fever, Aedes aegypti, is notorious for biting around the ankles, and as a consequence of it being so subtle, it often escapes the attention of the householder, where it may actually be living, coexisting with. Whereas, as you mentioned, Leonard, other species favor biting around the face, and I've been captured with a mosquito biting my nose, which is very characteristic of some of the tribes, Sabathini, that's very common.
Or our wrists and our arms as well.
Yes.
Why don't people feel the mosquito landing on them and drinking their blood?
With the saliva of mosquitoes, oftentimes contains an anesthetic that inhibits.
How clever of them.
Yes, the any reaction that might disturb them from being interrupted during their feeding sequence, the cocktail that's injected in the mosquito's saliva is incredibly sophisticated in terms of not only the mosquito's own biochemical machinery, but can include, of course, the pathogens that are transmitted by mosquitoes. So that whole salivary gland is very key to not only the mosquito's success in blood feeding, but also its importance as a transmitter of disease.
Now we're going to go to some calls, but the reason that the females are the ones who give us the bites is because they're using our blood to feed their eggs?
That's correct. Those mosquitoes that do take blood, and as Anand mentioned, there are a few that have bypassed that, need the protein from blood for manufacturing the next generation of little mosquitoes.
How nice of us to give them that. Let's take some calls. Susan from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I have two questions important to me. One is I cannot use DEET, which is one of the main repellents being used in things. I was told I can't use that by doctors. And I find the natural forms of repellents, citronella and so forth, don't work at all. So I wish you'd address that. And the second question is my mosquito bites flourish. They blow up and sometimes they get infected. So I'm wondering if you can talk about that as well.
Okay. Well, first of all, let's talk about DEET, which from what I understand may still be the most effective deterrent for mosquitoes. All of those machines and other things seem to only work partially, but DEET does tend to keep them off. But it's chemicals, isn't it? Is it good for us?
Well, DEET has been around for many, many years. In fact, DEET was discovered in the early 1940s and deployed during World War II. It was discovered by chance by the U.S. military, who were screening to find chemicals that could protect soldiers who were being infected by mosquito-borne diseases. The sad aspect to this is since 1940, there has been very little innovation in improving upon DEET, and it has been a real challenge to do so. However,
what's in DEET? It's not DDT, is it?
No, it isn't. It's a chemical. It's an artificial chemical that can be smelled by the mosquito's olfactory system as a repellent. And when a mosquito lands, the mosquito senses through its legs DEET as a bitter compound. So it has two effects on the mosquito. First, it sort of is a repellent that the mosquito doesn't like to smell, but when it lands, it also tastes bitter to them, and so they avoid it.
And why would Susan be allergic to it, and other people?
Well, there has been a concern that DEET can, along with these two roles, can also block an enzyme called acetylcholinesterase. This is an important chemical in the nervous system that is required for neurotransmission. And so if you were to put mosquitoes along with DEET for a short while, and if you were to put them together in a little container, the mosquitoes would start dying after a little while. So in fact, they do have an additional effect on this enzyme that is required for neurotransmission. And so the fear is that prolonged use could perhaps lead to this chemical also affecting the enzyme in humans. We also have acetylcholinesterase, and this is one of the fears, but I'm not sure there's any data to support that. It's also a solvent, so DEET can dissolve plastics, nylon, and there is a chance that it could go through skin. And there are instances that have been reported, although rare, that it can be harmful and have neurological symptoms in some individuals. And that's why DEET is not recommended for use with newborn babies, for example. As far as a solution for a replacement to DEET, I think an existing solution that your caller may want to try is picaridine. It's another class of repellent that is slightly different from the structure of DEET, and perhaps this may be effective, more effective than some of the natural solutions out
there. Is that available in our local pharmacy?
Yes, it is.
Now,
yes,
there are all sorts of other things. People suggest garlic, using a fan. There is citronella. Are any of them more effective than others? What about those plug-ins or the ones that use, what is it, not benzene, but...
It's a pyrethroid insecticide that is used in some of the plug-in dispensers. There's a variety of different ways in which you can repel mosquitoes from an area or from your body. Certainly some of these natural solutions that are marketed, like citronella, geraniol, they work somewhat. They are effective. It's just that you will need to apply them and reapply them over and over again. Some of them have strong smells, and so they aren't as effective as DEET or picaridine, which is also available in the
Philip,
market.
Philip, do you want to join in on this?
I'm listening. Anand is a world's authority on this field, and I'm learning a lot by just listening to his commentary.
Well, what would you do if you were going out into a mosquito-infested area? Would you just put on DEET?
With caution, and I do work a lot in the tropics where there are mosquito-borne diseases, and I think wearing protective clothing is underestimated as a very good method of warding off.
There is certain clothing that actually promises to protect us against mosquito bites. Does that work?
That's true. And Anand mentioned the pyrethroid chemicals, which are some of those that were developed by the Army, and then the clothing was infused with this chemical, and it certainly has a long-lasting effect for warding off mosquitoes. But I also recommend just covering up in a way such that you limit the amount of available skin that is out there for a mosquito to bite. I know that summer is coming and everyone wants to expose to a lot of that skin, but for maximizing for your health, and particularly to this caller who has a horrible skin reaction, I think...
We have to leave it there, unfortunately. Philip Lunabus is a professor at the Institute of Food and Agricultural Studies at the Florida Medical Entomology Laboratory. And Dr. Anand Sankar Ray is Associate Professor of Entomology at University of California, Riverside. Thank you both so much.